welcome to the Unknown Strength Podcast ADCC Competitor Series. This is a second installment featuring Australian BJJ Black Belt standout, Craig Jones. So before we get into this interview, we have an exciting announcement to make. The Unknown Strength Podcast is now officially sponsored by the MMA Fight Store. Go to MMAFightStore.com.au for the very best range of premium boxing, Muay Thai, Jiu-Jitsu and MMA gear. Also be on the lookout for the new Hayabusa T3 range, which is landing very soon. The website again is MMAFightStore.com.au.
Excellent. And in other news here at the Unknown Strength, we are launching the first ever group online strength and conditioning training program specifically for fight athletes. Over the last few years, we've been working extensively with fighters, both online and in person. And the number one issue we keep coming up against, or the biggest barrier to entry for aspiring fight athletes to take on high-level strength and conditioning coaching, is the financial cost of it. So what we've done with this program is we've really bundled together a cost-effective, high-level training and coaching solution, and we've presented it in a group format. So whether you're a striker, a grappler, or an MMA fighter, this program is designed specifically to build the foundations of strength, stability, mobility, conditioning, and injury prevention to see you through a long and successful career. So if you're a beginner to high-level strength and conditioning training and you want to take your performances to the next level, then this program is designed for you. The launch is in late September, so for more information, please send us a message on Facebook or email me at mac@theunknownstrength.com. Now, without further ado, here is the interview with the one and only Craig Jones.
Craig Jones, an absolute pleasure to have you on the Unknown Strength Podcast. Thank you for coming down into the studio.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So a very big few years for you lately. You seem to be making yourself very relevant in quite a number of the big tournaments and at the very least headlining anything this side of the world. So some of your titles include IBJJF No-Gi World Champion, Grapple Asia Champion very recently this year, ADCC Trials winner, and this would be your second time going over, Abu Dhabi World Pro semi-finalist at the Brown Belt and the Gi, Hyperflow Pro Champion also this year, Zapatero Champion this year, Eddie Bravo Invitational semi-finalist, losing very narrowly to Vanya Rocha, Naga World Champion, Grappling Industries Pro Open Champion, and I feel like I'm barely scratching the surface. Was there anything else I missed there?
No, that sounds pretty good. Zapatero, I actually lost. I've lost that twice, unfortunately.
You lost that twice?
Lost that twice.
I don't know what we're doing having you on now.
Hopefully I can get that third one.
No worries. So how did the last tournament go down?
Well, the last tournament, actually, they were giving away an M16. So I thought that would be a really good idea, fly down to Florida, try and win that gun. But I ended up, I won the first two matches, and I lost the third one to Matthew Tesla from Danaher's team.
Right.
It was too charged for you. Too charged. I managed to avoid the heel hooks, but he beat me in overtime.
Yep. So that was EBI rules?
EBI rules, yeah.
Okay. So obviously he rode the clock a little bit and escaped and...
He got like a neck crank, some sort of face choke.
He finished me in overtime.
I was in quite a bit of pain for a few days after that, actually.
Yeah, right.
But if I'd won the gun, it would have been worth it.
Yeah, the EBI rules, put your body under quite a lot more stress, huh? When you're in those overtime rounds, you're starting off in an armbar, or you're starting off literally getting your face cranked. And in fact, you were trying to do that to Vanya Rocha on EBI yourself.
Definitely. A big fan of the face choke. Sometimes the overtime round comes down to whoever's tougher, especially if they choose to take the armbar. A lot of guys aren't going to tap to that armbar.
And what they can be, I mean, there's virtually no limit on the time, right? You could go for another 10, 20 minutes of just having your face cranked or, you know, doing a bicep curl for half an hour until you just can't handle it.
Exactly. And that's what I thought Gio was doing in his last match with Eddie. He put him in the spiderweb position and was really trying to fatigue his arm. I think that was the strategy the whole time. Very smart.
Yeah, amazing. So I spoke to your coach, Lachlan Giles, earlier, and so apparently your nickname around town is Littlefinger.
Uh-oh.
Can you verify this, or is he just having a bit of a crack?
He's trying to make it happen. I mean, I don't get the reference. I don't watch Game of Thrones, but apparently there's a Game of Thrones reference.
See, I do watch Game of Thrones, and I'm struggling with the reference a little bit. Maybe Mac has something he can shed on this.
Well, my thought was, you know, maybe, you know, you when you're grappling, you've got everyone wrapped around your little finger. Man, that's the best I can come up with.
Well, definitely Lachlan Giles. cars. So.
Well, you also did claim that you defy physics. I had a conversation with him earlier, and I said, look, you know, what makes Craig Jones so challenging to grapple with? So he said, you obviously defy physics, and he says that you think you have him in a good position, but you don't. So.
Well, I mean, he does get me in plenty of good positions, so I think he's just being quite nice to me.
maybe perhaps to do with the fact, I think you're, you know, 2 years ago you're a lightweight, and now you've been progressively bulking all the way up to almost a heavyweight.
Yeah, man, burgers and bicep curls.
Gonna make those face cranks extra tough.
Exactly.
So it's how do you feel about your performance back in 2015, I guess, when you won the 2015 World Championships, the Purple Belt. Since then, a lot has happened. You've been just smashing tournaments all over the place. I think you had one of the most glorious submissions I've ever seen in competition, where you landed the Broglio Steamer reverse, or as we were discussing before, is it reverse or inverse? It was a weird angle.
Yeah, it's the same triangle choke Braulio landed on Andre Gavau at ADCC, I believe. But yeah, that tournament was huge for me. I actually had left my team, I believe, my original team 6 weeks previous. So I spent that Nogi Worlds Camp training in my friend's living room on 3x3 mats. And it was just me, Lachlan Warne, and my friend Simon Cho. So it was like the least prepared I've ever been for a tournament, but it was maybe my best performance. So I don't know what that says.
How did you feel going into it, though? Did that factor in your mind? Were you nervous, or was it a little bit carefree because you thought, look?
It was a bit of both. I felt carefree because of the poor prep, but at the same time, when you do leave a team, you do want to do well at those tournaments afterwards.
Right, right. Oh, was there a bit of bad blood there with one of you? Because you were living, you're from Adelaide, right?
From Adelaide, yeah.
Whereabouts in Adelaide for your fans back home?
Down south, like Aberfoyle Park. But I was training at a team called Ice Health. My coach ran that team, and we had a falling out over time, didn't see eye to eye.
Yeah.
So when I left that team, there was a bit of bad blood.
So you're actually over to Absolute MMA. So was that actually one of the reasons that you made the move, or was it looking for a new pond to dominate?
I really had to come out to Melbourne to take my game to the next level. Adelaide was very limited, and my coach at the time wouldn't allow cross-training in Adelaide. So it was like we're talking about quite a small team in quite a small city, and like unless you're utilizing everyone in that small environment, you're really not going to make it very far. Not enough problems to solve, if you know what I mean. Like you, same handful of people every day training with.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with that. I think you actually just start to become better at solving the same sort of problem in some different sort of ways, but you're not exactly being presented a new challenge to open up your game. So were you a purple belt this time?
I was a purple belt. I got my brown belt at the end of 2015.
Yeah, right. And so you recently awarded your black belt by Lachlan Giles at Absolute MMA St Kilda. So, becoming a black belt, how's your experience changed? You know, has your eyes opened up to jiu-jitsu in a very different way?
I just see it as a bigger challenge now. When I'm training, though, I feel like a lot more people are trying to take your head off because you're a black belt. You know what I mean? Everyone wants to take the black belt, but I think that's good for competition prep.
Yeah, nice. So, I guess just going back one step, you've moved over from South Australia. You've decided you had to move into Melbourne. Obviously, in Adelaide, to my knowledge, there aren't that many black belts. There's a handful of some really good black belts over there. I know Kane Gehling's really good. You've got a few that are sort of scattered. So obviously, I think that makes your training a lot more challenging when you've got a limited amount of training partners. Do you have a lot of high-level partners back there in your gym, or was that one of the reasons that motivated you to move?
Yeah, that would be the main reason I left. My main training partner was Lachlan Warne, who was the same belt. He's a brown belt now, trains with at Absolute as well. I didn't get to utilize any of the other black belts in the city. And at the time, my coach was a brown belt. He's never competed. The guys on his team were very active on the comp scene. So it was really just me and Lachlan Warren training for a couple of years. We'd drill every day. We'd go to tournaments together. And looking back, I'm surprised we had the success we did in that situation.
Yeah, I think it definitely says a lot. I mean, obviously it comes down to you being, loving jiu-jitsu and just being motivated to learn and just voraciously digest as much information as possible.
Yeah, definitely had to make up for a lot of lost time there.
So I guess, was there anything else really sort of surrounding the sort of situation back then? Was it a difficult move to make, like with friends and family back home? Or I think the dream was that strong that it was an easy move?
Once I got the job teaching at Absolute, it made the move a whole lot easier because I could really pursue jiu-jitsu in a professional way. Had that not been the case, and had I not had the same amount of friends out here with Absolute from previously training with them, the move would have been a whole lot more difficult. But a lot of the guys really helped me out. Simon helped me out. Lockie helped me out.
So did you have the job lined up before moving to Melbourne, or you moved out to Melbourne, took a bit of a gamble, and it went from there?
Well, just before Nogi Worlds, I did, I think, a five-day training camp with Absolute, and, like, they just offered me a job on the spot, so it was perfect.
That's awesome.
So you recently qualified for ADCC, which is obviously the pretext for this interview. What can you tell us about your journey to qualifying for the event, and what can you tell us about the event itself?
It was actually a really interesting event. Last time I qualified was in South Korea, and this time was in Kazakhstan. So coming into Kazakhstan, I had no idea what to expect. We've all seen Borat, but it was an amazing place. The guys put on a really good tournament. The guys in Kazakhstan have like a wrestling judo base, and they really love combat sports over there. So the guys that organized the trials, I think they said they spent $3-4 million on a jiu-jitsu arena there.
Wow.
So they purpose-built an arena for the event.
Yeah.
Okay. In hopes that, I believe, down the track they're going to get the ADCC Worlds there.
Is it completed?
Fully completed. That's what we did, the trials there, and I think that was like a test run. But it's like, yeah, those guys take jiu-jitsu very seriously. Mm-hmm. The athletes, they're all very good, but their belt levels are low just due to the limited amount of black belts in Kazakhstan. I imagine it's quite hard to send an email out to a black belt around the world and be like, would you like to come to Kazakhstan to teach? Obviously, people have their expectations, but the guys there are very, very tough. So, like, I train with them after the tournament, and yeah, they like the blue belts there are very high level, mm-hmm. and with the wrestling base, very, very good, takedown game. Mm-hmm. So when I competed over there, I believe I fought four matches. It was the first match was against a local guy, it was pretty tough. The second match was a Kyrgyzstan guy who I previously fought in the finals in 2014 in South Korea. Really tough guy. I fought another guy, Keller from Sydney. You guys might know him as a judo black belt as well.
Yeah, I competed against him myself.
Yeah, he's an animal.
He is. He's got very strong grips.
Very strong grips. So we had a war. I think I ended up winning via a takedown. And then in the final match, actually, I fought a guy from Kyrgyzstan who, it was an easier opponent than Keller, but I actually put him in an armbar. He tapped, and the ref didn't see it, so we had to keep going. So I had to tap him twice. So that was super annoying, but I held that last one on quite a long time.
a lot harder to secure that second submission.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, they have that wrestling base, so it's really hard. Mm. And in ADCC, a wrestling advantage goes so far because of the way the overtime rules are structured. Like, they force an overtime, and then if you don't have the wrestling, it's quite easy to get a takedown and stall out.
Mm-hmm. So obviously that'd be a principal focus for yours now, really working on that wrestling to make sure no one's going to stall you out. I mean, as I was saying to you before the show, it seems that the level you've sort of grown to now, being literally one of the very best in the world, a lot of people sort of look at your tricky style and have to look to stifle you and shut you down by essentially neutralizing you. So I would expect that quite a few people might look at your EBO highlights, look at some of your other tournaments around and realize, okay, this is a guy I need to bring into the overtime rounds, get that takedown, and hopefully win.
Yeah, I mean, this ADCC camp's just been two things. It's been wrestling and leg locks. Like, I'm trying to use the leg lock game that I was able to implement at EBI, but also I want that wrestling so that I don't have to worry about the overtime round as much. I want to be comfortable in implementing my game plan during the regulation, and if it goes to overtime, it goes to overtime, and I feel like given the average level of wrestling at jiu-jitsu, the high-level jiu-jitsu guys have, I should be able to hang in there with them.
Nice. So I guess, like, essentially with your wrestling at this point in time, do you see yourself more, is it more just counter wrestling, or are you starting to get to the point now where you feel comfortable looking for takedowns and, you know, landing a few different exciting slams of your own?
Definitely both. I've actually, when I first started training for the ADCC, I was sort of like, I wasn't really into wrestling, but like over time I've really grown to love it. And I think even if I were not to qualify for ADCC again, I would definitely keep up the same level of wrestling training.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first time I saw you competing, I mean, you epitomize that guard guy, you know, super flexible, long legs. I think you earned yourself a reputation around Australia, just probably around the world now as well, for your Z guard triangles. Like, it's just, I think that's what Lockie's referring to when he says you defy physics. I remember at Abu Dhabi, you know, the way you can, you know, unlatch your leg from underneath someone and slap on that triangle is ridiculous.
Yeah, I think from purple belt to the start of black belt, I really only had one move, and that was the Z-guard triangle. But it worked very well, better than expected.
So how's the preparation coming along now? You're only a few weeks away from the grappling event against the best in the world, second time there. Obviously, it's going to be held in Finland, in Helsinki.
Yeah, the prep's going excellent. Me and Giles are training two solid sessions a day, but like again, lots and lots of wrestling. So I would say it's even more exhausting than regular training. So it's killing me right now. It's going to kill Lockie worse when he has to start cutting weight. I'm looking forward to that.
Nice. So you'll be coming into the 88 kilo division. We have Lachlan at the 77 kilo division.
Lachlan at 77. Yeah, I was actually 80 kilos or maybe 82 kilos about 12 months ago before the trials in Kazakhstan. And me and Giles fought in the gym to see who got to do 77. And as you can see, he won. So.
Oh, really? That's very honorable. I actually like that. That's interesting. I mean, so 88 kilos is clearly not your normal weight division. You're normally either around a lightweight or middleweight. So how have you actually put this weight on, I guess, in a healthy way? I mean, you're smiling, so I'm guessing it's not the most healthy way.
Just lots and lots of calories. Just, yeah, lots of lifting. What is it like? Actually, I listened to Dorian Yates podcast. That's what started this whole thing. I listened to what weights he was lifting, and it was pretty much just bench press, squats, and deadlifts. Yeah. And I've always done weightlifting, but never to failure. So I think pushing that to failure and eating just a sickly amount has pushed me over the line.
Do you find it helps? Obviously, you're getting a lot more calories in. I mean, you're training two times a day, maybe sometimes three. I mean, you're having some very high intensity training sessions. It's got to be very different to when you're trying to make weight for a tournament and trying to balance that energy in training sessions. And you're in a calorie deficit, but this time, you know, you're feasting on burgers and shakes and just smashing it.
Yeah, I mean, it feels great. Really, I love eating. So like, I love eating unhealthy food. So that's some good calories there. Feels great being a lot heavier than Lockie at the moment too.
Sounds like there's a bit of a rivalry there.
Yeah, he's definitely hating me being this big. I think I can get away from some of the moves that would have once killed me just purely because of the size, which I think could be frustrating, hopefully frustrating.
I can see why he's tried to slip in the little finger reference. Yeah. So your strength training, what does a schedule look like for you? Are you lifting a few times a week?
Bench, squats, and deadlifts twice a week, and then depending on how I feel, just sort of like some bicep curls, whatever I can do to just gain some size, you know what I mean? If depending on the energy levels, I'll just hit the gym really hard and then base how I feel the next few days, you know what I mean? If I'm like too sore, I'm gonna rest. I don't want to lift so much that I can't train properly, but sometimes that happens. It has been quite hard to put on the size in terms of training 2-3 times a day, like to get the calories in but be able to feel good for training. Like, I don't want to eat too much breakfast and be slow at training. That's really the toughest part.
I got two questions for you about that.
Yeah.
Of course you do.
Of course I do. Firstly, how are you structuring all of the lifting, and how are you doing it in a way that kind of leaves you with enough energy in the tank to do all that jiu-jitsu and all that grappling as well?
Yep. In terms of the lifting, what was I doing? I'll do about just three sets. I'll do about a 50% set, an 80% set, and then I'll do like as much as I think I can lift and try and aim for that 8 to 12 rep range. Mm-hmm. And really, really push it to failure. I've been working out mainly with my friend Tom, so we've been trying to make sure the form's correct, but I mean, this is just some bro science here. But yeah, like just push it. I'll ease off if it starts to affect my training.
Right.
But I'll try and do it. Like Tuesdays and Thursdays would be the hardest jiu-jitsu sessions of the week, so I'll try and lift actually after that, and hopefully I'm recovered
yep.
for the next session.
Yeah, I mean, well, lifting to failure, I mean, that's the thing that's really going to bring on the soreness.
And, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, so you want to be careful where you structure that. That's kind of what I'm interested in. But if you're positioning it after those heavy grappling sessions, that makes a lot of sense.
Definitely. And in terms of wrestling as well, like being sore for wrestling is a nightmare. Mm. I feel like you want to be as fresh as possible. But like in this ADCC camp, I've spent my weekends doing largely nothing. Like mm-hmm. I train really hard, but I'm do a lot of nothing. You know what I mean? So like I'm trying to maximize that recovery.
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
What does nothing? What does a day of nothing in the life of Craig Jones look like?
Oh man, just on the couch, hey, watching Netflix, movies, anything, sauna, some light swimming,
Ben and Jerry's,
yeah, anything I can get my hands on, really.
Yeah, nice. So if you weren't doing jiu-jitsu, then what do you think you would be doing as a career or even recreationally?
Oh man, I have no idea. I really have no idea. I did a psychology degree at uni, but I don't know how that would have panned out. I finished the bachelor's, but it looked like a long road ahead of me to get that, to be practicing.
Yeah, nice. I did a psychology undergraduate as well, and I remember at one point I was considering being a psychologist, and I looked at the road ahead, and for me, at that point in time, my investment in academia was a little bit starting to wane, so it's a long and daunting road ahead.
Yeah, very.
Oh, but it's good. You've got a bachelor's degree under your belt. So how much, you train with some serious beasts out here in Melbourne. As you said, you've trained with Lachlan Giles, you've got Livia, you've got Ben Hodgkinson, Mikhail, quite another other people as well who hold world titles themselves or have at least made it to those final rounds, and even, you know, veterans in ACC. So what do you think it is that's leading to the success of Absolute MMA in particular in that gym? Like, what are these characteristics or methodologies that are fostering this level of success?
I think just a lot of like-minded athletes going after the same thing, working together. There's no bullshit. Like, we're not a team that doesn't cross-train. Like, I think those teams that don't cross-train really limit themselves versus, like, anyone can come to our team. We get visitors all the time from other gyms, even if that means they have to sit out of the group photos at the end. But we're just essentially throwing down every day.
Even when you say sitting out of the photos, like, so their coaches aren't seeing them on Facebook and Instagram and pulling them aside.
Yeah, it's like your friends that stay out of the photos when you go out so their girlfriends don't see them.
Oh, I just find that really sad. That I think it's just very frustrating, unfortunate. There's, you know, friendship. I mean, you forge some, when you train jiu-jitsu to the level you are, I mean, the people you train with ultimately become your best friends. And the fact is that they can be deprived from you because of politics is a very, you know, very frustrating ordeal. I've trained at gyms where I've had to sort of move around a little bit to, you know, face that same dilemma myself. And I think, you know, my growth on a personal level only opened up once I was able to move and just start experimenting with different people, different bodies, seeing different games. For example, I remember when I went to Italy, virtually no one played spider guard or anything, and strangely I started playing around with open guards and spider guards and trying out different things I never would actually practice, yet they were so amazing at smashing half guard that I just never felt like playing it, so I was forced to play a different game.
Exactly. The more people you train with, the more problems you get to solve, and that's what tournaments are, solving problems, right? And I think anyone that doesn't allow cross-training, it's protection. Like, their thoughts must be protection of investment or insecurity. Like, if you really believed in your product, your students could leave, train wherever they want, they'd come back. And
Absolutely. That's really
the end of the argument there. There's nothing else to it.
I mean, obviously, you know, your gym is about creating a culture and an environment that, you know, does foster that growth. So in your eyes, what do you think makes a very successful gym? I mean, I guess competition is one aspect of it. Right now, you're a very heavily competition-focused athlete. But I guess in a more holistic sense, what do you think is valuable and important for a culture and a club?
Just generous training partners in terms of their time and knowledge. Everyone's training safely, not trying to hurt each other. I really think that's it. That's the best part, is that, like, you limit the frustrations, people bickering with each other. Like, we're all there to have fun at the end of the day. Everyone's there helping each other out.
I guess you go through some challenging times and everyone's cutting weight and you get a little bit grumpy and stuff.
For sure.
And there's you just smashing burgers.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. At ADCC, all the other guys at the buffet are going to be eating light. I'm going to be throwing cake on my plate, some burgers.
Having some Helsinki food. So the last time you were at ADCC, you qualified for that, I believe. I think you submitted your way to the final as well, and then the trials in Kazakhstan.
Yeah, I think four matches, four submissions. That one was in South Korea, the previous one.
Sorry, South Korea. So you qualified for that. Again, you were in the 88-kilo division then. You drew Homilo Bahal in the first round. And I think you even managed to set up a very sneaky De La Riva footlock. So how close was it?
You know what, at the time I probably thought it was close, but in retrospect, and if you guys saw Homolo's match recently, it doesn't look like he taps the footlocks.
Yeah.
So that, like, essentially for me competing at the higher level, that's how my whole approach has changed, is really realizing that you have to choke these guys. Like, I mean, Leandro Lowe, he's not tapping any bars, Paul Lemieux's not tapping any heel hooks. Like, you could be the best heel hooker in the world, but if he doesn't tap, like, that's it. You've lost. So I think, like, really realizing that has helped a lot, and that's what my focus was for EBI. That's why I chose to always take the back over the armbar, because a lot of guys don't tap the armbars. I will.
So there's obviously quite a bit of a split there. When it comes to EBI, I noticed that Livia and Lachlan both sort of pursued that armbar spiderweb position, whereas yourself, you were electing to take the back, given that Vanya Hosha took you to those overtime rounds. It looked like you're setting up a really funky kind of arm-in, head-and-arm choke. I mean, it looked It looked awkward, yet it strangely seemed to be also having an effect. So what were you actually looking for there?
It's a choke variation I've seen Keenan do. I was really using it to see, like, first of all, you can get the submission with it. Like, especially I've got quite long arms for my division, so, like, you can finish that submission. But his reaction to it, I was looking for a certain type of defense that I could move on to the next progression. But he hung in there. He hung tough. I heard some noises, but he was not going to tap.
Yeah, you have to put him out. So at the Eddie Bravo Invitational, you were on fire. You submitted your way in quick succession to meet Fanny Hosher in the semi-final, who he narrowly beat you on a ride time. But all throughout, you looked very threatening. So Vanny appeared to adopt a more tactical approach in the EBI. So in ADCC, you have an opening round that isn't scored, but the subsequent component of the match is scored. So how do you prepare for a change in tactics for a situation like this, where you may face an opponent yet again who looks to drag the match out and utilize a rule system to beat you and avoid the submission game?
Yeah, it's very tough. I guess the rules can be exploited in both. And that's, at the end of the day, you have to prepare for that, whether you like it or not. Like, to be honest, I don't love the EBI rules. I don't like the idea of someone getting to start on an arm or getting to start on my back without having actually earned it. But at the same time, I don't like the idea that in ADCC you can force an overtime and win via wrestling. So it's very tricky. You've just really got to spend time training those weak areas you have. And hopefully that one day people won't see that as something they can exploit. And it's like an equally dangerous area for you.
Yeah, right. I mean, specifically in the EBI rule set, the overtime round consists of an opponent winning a coin toss and then electing to begin in the spiderweb position or the armbar position, as it's also known as, or the back with two hooks in. So as we touched on with Lachlan and Liv, they sort of looked for the different options there. So, I mean, what do you think the strategy is behind that? We're looking to take the armbar. Is it just to fatigue the arms?
That is a tough one. I think Lockie and Liv have a smaller frame, so that is best for the armbar. I think their armbar is going to be better. It's going to be tighter. There's going to be less space. And at the same time, being of a smaller frame, it'll be harder to hold and control the back. It's going to be easier for someone with long legs like me to secure the body triangle. So I think that's what they were looking for with that strategy. But at the same time, like I said, I didn't really want to go for the armbar, given the fact that, like, even if I landed at flush, if you're willing to take a few pops, you can still get out of there.
Yeah, right, especially in the semi-finals, if you can make your way to the final and sort of wrestle your way around and drag them into another overtime.
Definitely.
So I guess sort of changing direction here a little bit, operating in line with the traditional standard jiu-jitsu model via BJJF, leg locks are prohibited until brown belt and black belt. Your leg locks in particular have been devastating at the highest level. Are they something you began to focus on once you reached brown and black, or was it something you always had an eye on and always, they always appealed to you?
They didn't appeal to me until I qualified for the first ADCC, and I really started looking into them purely out of fear in the fact that these were now part of the game. I think my first heel hook tournament was in 2014. I did a Naga, and I did a ADCC North American Nationals, and I really saw how dangerous the leg locks were, and I tried to put as much time and energy in as I could. But in Adelaide at the time, like, my coach, like a lot of us, like a lot of people around the world, didn't really understand how leg locks worked. Really took the Danaher crew, they took it to another level. And that's how I've sort of developed my game, is really watching as much tape as possible and trying to adapt what they're doing to here. But I mean, it is a lot of trial and error.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I like how you, I think that is a really challenging point when you've got, you're over in the States, you've got like a vast array of leg lock specialists, people who have you've got Dean Lister, you've got the Danaher Death Squad, who seem to be tearing everyone's heels off. How do you actually grow and develop your own leg lock game without having access to those resources locally? And, you're watching video footage, but I'm sure there's a myriad of techniques that they never really got to unveil on that stage. There's lots of things we'll probably only see in, tournaments over the next few years. So how do you keep up on, how do you develop that aspect of leg locks?
Just training every day in the gym. I mean, having a really competitive team like we do, everyone's trying to kill each other. I mean, there's a lot of bragging rights everyone's looking for, so that really pushes you to train a bit harder. You want to be the one winning those exchanges in the gym. And I think when people are so competitive with each other, we begin to understand the game a bit better, and we can sort of adapt that and really take it to the other people around the world.
So how do you see your leg lock stacking up against a specialist like someone from the Danaher Death Squad? I mean, do you think you've taken it far enough, you're safe, or do you think you'd be looking for the finish there as well?
I would definitely engage the leg lock battle, but I would try and have a strategy to it. Like, I wouldn't want to
trade.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to go in there and trade leg locks with them, but I would use my entries to secure the heel hook. So I wouldn't go in there and put them in 50-50 yard, but I might try and enter the saddle. That's the strategy I'd have. Like, I mean, why go straight for their strength? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I think it'd be a really interesting matchup to see against someone like Gordon Ryan, who actually is in your weight division, who's, you know, the king, quote-unquote.
I've tried. It's hard to get. It's hard to fight Conor McGregor, you know what I mean?
So the social media call-outs seem to play a part in the modern day. I think you were trying to call out Vanya Rocha for a rematch.
I tried. All my call-outs have failed so far.
It got you on the EBI, I believe, so enough people were throwing your name and pitting you against people.
Yeah, that's actually, quite a few supportive people on my social media networks have helped me get these shots. A lot of people ask me, how do you get the shot? And it's really, when they do the call out, get people to tag your name. Like, that's what they want to see.
Yeah, right. So I often look at your grappling style. I think you're analogous to a bear trap. You know, you're calm and patient, loaded like a snare, waiting a careless limb to wander in and for you to claim. So as I mentioned, lately that's been ligaments of the lower extremities. So how would you actually describe your style or your philosophy of jiu-jitsu, and how does it make you different from other grapplers out there?
That's a tough one. That is a tough one. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm always looking for the submission, but at the same time, I do appreciate the points game. Like, it's tricky, especially when I'm teaching my own students, because I'm telling them, like, I'm like, forget about the submission, play for points, be safe, do you know what I mean? Hold good positions. But then everything I've ever done has gone against that. But I think I've been lucky in that sense, I guess, that it's paid off for me. But I mean, yeah, it's a tough question.
So obviously you're still a believer in the, you know, position before submission. I mean, that's obviously, that's a fundamental component of being able to lead to the submission. But in terms of when you look at the formats like EBI and ADCC, I think, at least in my opinion, I feel like the style, the way the fights play out are very different. People are less willing to engage and expend energy, I think. You know, you look at some of the leg entanglements, it's people sort of sit back a little bit. And how do you feel these different formats foster a different style of grappling?
Every rule set's gonna have something different. People are gonna exploit it and make it look bad in certain respects, but I do think the point system is the best. Do you know what I mean? We need a way to measure dominance. And if someone passes to mount, that should be rewarded. Like, you shouldn't be letting people pass the mount, right? So it should be rewarded. And then in that sense, now that you're down on points, it's up to you to take that risk to get out of the position. And then that's where either you get out or the person on top improves position or gets the submission. I really, truly believe that's the way it should work. You know what I mean? It's not up to me to submit you from mount. It's up to you to get out of mount. Mm. And in that risk you take, because you've made an error, is when the submission will occur. Mm. And that's what I think EBI can miss at times. And I think that's what, well, the EBI rule set, and I think that's why there's sometimes less submissions in sub-only events versus points events.
Yeah.
Like, say, for example, my back's been taken in EBI in the regulation, there's 30 seconds to go. Do I take a risk to get out?
Mm.
Definitely not. Do you know what I mean? I'm going to force the overtime. But if my back's taken in an IBJJF match, I need to take a risk, and that's where I might get submitted.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see exciting matches in all the formats, but I think, you know, some of the most exciting matches I've seen is when the scores are tied or there's an advantage and there's 30 seconds to go, and you'll see 20 transitions in that last 30 seconds just chasing that advantage or just to see the ref award advantage. I know a lot of, you know, advantages get a lot of heat, so I'd love to hear your take on it.
On advantages? I mean, I think they should exist. It's like how points exist. It's something else to measure a victory. I think it forces the action too. Like, again, just like points force the action, if you're down on points, you're down on advantages, it'll force the action. Whereas maybe if advantages weren't in but the scores were tied, the rest of the match would be at a slower pace. So I think it does make it more entertaining. I think less people, the average person isn't going to appreciate the point style as much because they don't understand it. But submission only is going to appeal to a broader audience because it's so simple to understand. That guy is trying to make that guy tap.
Mm.
So I think that's the benefit for sub only.
Yeah, except I think one of the trade-offs often, though, is, you know, it can, sort of as I highlighted, sort of deprive the audience of that intensity. And it's everyone knows they're looking for that submission. And I guess a jiu-jitsu format, I mean, jiu-jitsu often only appeals to jiu-jitsu people. Everyone likes to see highlight submissions and knockouts and all that sort of stuff, and everyone gets their head around the stand-up game. But jiu-jitsu is a, you know, quite a foreign beast when, you know, people are wrapping a lapel through the legs and doing more fancy and sophisticated techniques like worm guard.
Yeah, I think it's a tough one. I think jiu-jitsu could be a very entertaining sport to people, but at the same time, the points make it complicated. But I think if you sell a story, that's like, if the average person knows something about that competitor, like there's a build up to the fight, there's an expectation, they can pick a fan, that's where it becomes entertaining, even if they're not an expert at the rules. Just like if I turn on the TV and there was a random MMA fight on, I might have no interest in watching it. But if I knew the backstory to each of them, that's really the selling point. That's what I think Meta Morris did better than anyone with their countdown shows. Yeah. They made jiu-jitsu very entertaining.
Even the drama.
Even if the matches themselves weren't entertaining, even if I wouldn't re-watch those matches in the heat of the moment, that was very exciting.
Like, I think, that's a fantastic point. Like, if you looked at Hoyle Gracie and Ed Bravo, if you didn't know anything about them, that might... I have a very biased perspective on it, but if you didn't know either of those fighters, it might not have been that entertaining. You know, you saw someone's leg getting twisted, but that was a monumental fight because of what it meant to jiu-jitsu people at the time and the amount of shit-talking that had gone in the lead-up and the fact that, you know, you had one guy who... the Gracie's claim built his empire and his legacy on beating one of them, and then, you know, then you had Eddie Bravo trying to sort of validate himself and prove that, yeah, look, I do belong here.
Yeah, exactly. If you just turned that on, you didn't know the backstory, that would be quite a weird thing to watch. But like, the way they sold that was amazing. So like, you can sell anything. Like, as you guys know, like the McGregor Mayweather is sort of a bit of a weird fight to happen, but the way they sold it was the biggest spectacle ever.
And even all the people complaining about it, you know, the fact is we're still talking about it. It's a monumental cultural event, strangely enough. I mean, I don't think, apart from Game of Thrones and a few other sort of things going on beyond political issues, it's probably one of the most talked about things.
Yeah, 100%. People give Dylan Danis and Gordon Ryan, all these guys that talk shit on social media, they hate them, you know what I mean? But at the end of the day, like, if you don't like someone, you want to tune in and watch them lose.
Yeah, exactly.
So, like, they're getting the main card spots on all these events, so it's working.
So apart from your little friendly rivalry with Lachlan Giles, who's dubbed you Littlefinger, so we'll just keep reiterating that to make it stick, have you actually got any rivals out there? Seen anyone you've got sort of some heated blood that you need to sort them out?
Yeah, if you're going to make a call out right now.
If you're going to make a call out right now.
A call out. Obviously, I want the Wagner-Hosha match. Yeah. I'd love a match against, obviously, Tonin or Gordon Ryan. The tough part is everyone wants those matches. But, I mean, there's a few people on the list, but I'll hopefully get to them eventually, get some rematches eventually.
Yeah, I think it'd be an exciting match to see you and Keenan Cornelius, and you're in the same weight division this time, yeah?
Yeah, potentially for ADCC.
Yeah, that'd be very exciting. I mean, Keenan, I think, someone who brings a very exciting jiu-jitsu game and has invented a few of his own moves. And speaking of which, has there been any jiu-jitsu techniques that you think you've brought to the world or are in the works? Are we going to see anything special?
Any that I can claim? Nah, there's none that I can claim. I mean, every move's been adapted. I'd like to claim the armbar I landed on Richard, but that's a Braulio technique, so I won't steal that from him.
Nice. That's when they're in turtle and you basically just hoist them off the ground.
Yeah, a real degrading flipping armbar.
So I guess on the ADCC, it's a two-pronged question, Craig. If it's not you, who do you feel is the favorite for the 88-kilo weight division, and who would be your toughest matchup stylistically?
Oh, see, it's a tough one. Homolo's won it before. Keenan's medaled a couple times. Like, Gordon's really, really good, but I think he's going to be exploited. Like, I think he's going to be forced to overtime and he's going to be out-wrestled. I think, for me, that one of the most challenging guys would be Rustem. Did you guys know Rustem?
Yeah, Rustem Kiev.
Yeah, yeah. Most people recognize him. He wears, like, the tight shorts and the hairy back. I think he'd be the toughest because he's got the best wrestling. And I think he should be a favorite to win the division, but they haven't given him a fair go with the refs. Quite often, he loses really close decisions.
Yeah, right.
But I think he is one of the most dangerous guys in that division.
You'd have to think that all that back hair, though, would kind of eliminate the slipperiness, add a bit of friction, your triangles a little bit easier.
Yeah, help keep the closed guard shut.
Or at least when you're grabbing those, you know, capturing those legs, his legs won't slide away.
That's true. Or I'll use it as a handle.
But he's if I'm not mistaken, he's a leg locker himself to some degree, right? I mean, I've never seen him leg lock, but I know I know he's been purported to be a leg lock.
Yeah, I've seen him go for a lot of toe holds. See him rip a lot of toe holds.
He's just a beast, though, isn't he? He just grabs something and wants to snap it off.
Yeah, he's a scary dude. He looks like a villain from a movie or something.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see you match up against him. So I guess we had a question from some fans. You're a really composed competitor, perform extremely well in competition. How do you feel mentally when you compete? And do you have a routine to switch on, or are you looking more to tone yourself down, tone down that excitement and adrenaline?
It depends on the day. If I'm super nervous for an event, like, I'll try and be as relaxed as possible. But sometimes if I'm competing in a small event, I'm not that excited. I might be too relaxed. I might try and amp it up a bit. But I've got no secret to dealing with the nerves. Like, they're always there in some form. Mm. Sometimes, like for EBR, I felt very relaxed out there. Sometimes when there's less pressure on you, the nerves aren't as bad. But like, if I compete locally or against, when you're expected to win is when the nerves, they crush you. That's the toughest part.
I guess that's where the anxiety and sort of stuff comes from, really. When your expectations exceed, I guess, you know, when your expectations aren't met, that's when you're often unhappy.
For sure, for sure.
So what are some of your tactics to deal with, you know, that pressure and all of that stuff?
That pressure, I really just try and clear my mind of it as best I can. Maybe with some fun music. Try and stay focused on it, not too focused. Oh, it's tough. It's almost different every match. You know what I mean? Depends what I'm feeling going in. Mm. But yeah, really just trying to stay as calm as possible. Mm-hmm. Really a good warm-up. I really believe in a good warm-up. If you go out there cold, it can kill you. You get the deep breaths, you get the adrenaline dump. But a good warm-up, a fair chunk of time out, and then trying to stay warm up until the event, that'll kill a lot of the adrenaline dump.
Do you have any specific memorable experiences where you have been really nervous, or the anxiety and adrenaline has gotten to you and given you, you know, you've had a really poor performance that sort of reminds you to, you know, approach things differently?
Oh man, I've lost so many times. I don't hear, they all sting. I can't think of one in particular, but like, there's definitely times where maybe I've had too much coffee before the event and that'll definitely make me more nervous.
Yeah. So do you avoid coffee now?
Base it around how tired. Yeah. Try and find that sweet spot.
And obviously you're a big believer. Don't do anything differently. Do you have like a special breakfast or anything, or meal prep?
Well, I used to make a lot of mistakes. I used to cut a lot of weight. So on the day I wouldn't even eat anything. I'd just have a shot of coffee and stuff. And then I would such low energy out there.
Unbelievable.
I remember on the bus for the Abu Dhabi trials in Australia, I think when you're trying to make weight, I think you probably dropped from probably similar weight to where you are now, all the way down to lightweight. And you were eating peanut butter or Nutella just from the jar. That was your diet the whole trip.
The Nutella diet. Thank you, Reed Real, for that. That was like a... What did we do? We did
combat sports nutritionist recommended you that.
Nutella, yeah.
Genius. I love it.
We went low carb for quite a few days and then low residue near the event. So hopefully lots of sugar near the event to build up the glycogen.
Yep. So you're not holding a lot of actual physical weight in terms of food.
Exactly, yeah. And like, as you cut carbs, your water falls away. So like, I've cut carbs down to 50 grams a day before and lost like 5 kilos in 5 days.
Yeah.
But huge. It is a testing experience.
Yeah, I noticed Lachlan Giles did post quite a crazy transformation, I think within a week, of just pretty much removing carbs and, you know, so it's not holding that, drawing that water into your body. And again, just having like low volume but high calorie foods, you can actually shed a significant amount of weight.
Oh, definitely. And definitely. It's tough on the mind though. Like, people will bother you a whole lot more.
Yeah.
It's crazy how stressed out you can get with people.
Yeah, does it compromise? Did you find it compromise your performance much, or is it
it's tough to say. Sometimes I've cut weight and I felt like I've done it wrong and I've performed well, so there's like a number of factors that go into that. But I haven't cut weight for a while, luckily. Before EBI, I just did hot water baths because it was a morning weigh, and I got to weigh in at like 8 a.m and compete at like 4 or 5 p.m so I'll always choose cutting water over cutting my food, for sure.
I was just going to ask, what's been your experience with manipulating water, like water loads, you know, manipulating the salt, things like that? You just mentioned you go in the bath.
Yeah.
What's been your experience with other forms of water loading?
All right, yeah. I haven't cut salt and I haven't done the water loading, but I will do the carb cut. The carb cut is a tricky one because I wouldn't want a carb cut too much for a same day weigh-in, mm-hmm. or a right before match weigh-in, because I find that's just incredibly draining. Yeah. But I'll try and cut my meals down, the meal size down, see how close I can get to the weight for the day, for the same day right before match weigh-in. But for the day before weigh-in, like, I've cut 5-6 kilos in a day, and that's not too bad. That's not too bad.
Just sweating it out?
Just, yeah, sweating it out. So in Abu Dhabi was tough, actually. 1 year in Abu Dhabi, I cut 4.6 kilos in 24 hours, and I wasn't planning to cut that much, but I got sick the week before, and I couldn't train. I was just getting fatter and fatter. But then, what did I do? I took some over-the-counter herbals, diuretics in Abu Dhabi.
Dandelion tea?
Yeah, something weird, but it got the job done. I didn't eat for 24 hours. I had like 6 or 7 shots of coffee. I had some herbal extract, and then I was in the sauna. I actually trained that day as well. That lost a lot of weight. And then the sauna. EBI, though, is just hot water baths. I think I only had to drop 3-4 kilos.
Yeah, it's not too hard to do with a good bath.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's not as bad.
Yeah. So we sort of touched on this before, but what is your approach to growing as a grappler? And I mean, in terms of keeping that little finger of yours on the pulse to, you know, with what's going on with new techniques and games and so forth. So how's it really changed from, I say, your earlier belts? You know, you hit purple belt, you had a pretty solid game already. You know, how has your game started to shape from that trajectory? How is it taking form now?
I stay sharp really by just watching a lot of tape. I watch a lot of tape and I try out a lot of new things all the time. I mean, no one wants to get submitted, but training's training. Like, you get caught, you get caught. I'll really pick roles, and I'm training with someone and I want to work a guard pass, I'll just pass their guard, let him get it back, but I'll do the exact same pass. And no matter how many times I get it, no matter how new they are, eventually they figure it out. You know what I mean? They're going to put some obstacles in the way, and that's how I can improve it. Maybe if I've worked a new guard pass, I'll start on the lower belts and gradually progress up to someone like Lucky. But yeah, it's hard to work new technique on the guys that you're fighting for your life. Yeah.
So this sort of routine hasn't really changed since you hit black belt. It's not like you hit black belt and said, you know, you're not going to really work things this way. Things have to change. Your tried and true method has been to absorb as much material. Is it competition matches, or do you watch instructionals, or is it sort of everything really?
Just matches. And some of the best stuff you can watch is those match breakdowns, I think. I love the way they slow it down.
The BJJ Scout?
Yeah, BJJ Scout. There's a bunch of them, though. Some of those are really good. Like, you could spend 20 minutes watching one move, and like, usually I'll set up the move and I'll be hitting the space bar trying to see frame by frame, really try and see what they're doing there. Rafa Mendez might do a move in a match, but when he teaches it, something might get lost in translation. You know what I mean? But if I watch him do it, I can see exactly what he did. It's just going to take a bit more time just to see what he's getting at there.
Exactly, and he might not be cognizant of those actual details that make it effective. As you know, people make a lot of assumptions. You might just assume, yeah, of course you hold the elbow, but the detail I'm going to teach you is to grab the pole here, grab the ankle there, and do this and that.
Yeah, exactly. I think you watch instructionals, you might see a move that's never worked before, or you might see a move that's never worked on anyone good. And like, for me to really respect a move, I have to see it done on a high level opponent. Otherwise, I'm just wasting time, really. I'm like betting that move. Like, there's so many cool moves you see on Instagram, you're like, I wish that would work, but sometimes it does. But
yeah, I really like Mario Spieri when he's highlight outtakes, when he says, you know, I walk in the gym and I wake up and I'm in a runner's guard. And you're going to have to pass the guard. And you think, like, it's like that assumption, just, yeah, you've just landed there. You know, and Ryan Hall even had an outtake in one of his instructionals when he was showing, like, had a whole DVD dedicated to the entries of a half guard. And, you know, he's sort of criticizing a lot of other instructionals out there for just assuming that you're getting to these positions. Because if you get to deep half guard or whatever, and this is your game, like, Bernard Arthur here is going to score from there. So, you know, like, it's the whole lead up from that sequence that matters and knowing how to enter it. So paying attention to all those details is really important.
Yeah, 100%.
So you teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu at two of the absolute MMA gyms, I believe, St. Kilda and Collingwood?
Yeah. What is it? Collingwood Tuesday, Thursday nights, and St. Kilda every other day.
Yeah,
every other day, like Monday morning, Wednesday morning, Thursday morning, Friday morning, 6:30, and Monday, Friday.
6:30 in the morning.
6:30 in the morning. It's rough.
And what time are you teaching at night?
For Tuesday, Thursdays, it's like sometimes until 7:45. So it's rough. We'd leave Collingwood, get back to St. Kilda, go to bed, wake up at 6:30.
And so, like, Collingwood and St. Kilda are pretty much, well, not when I say polar opposites, but they're pretty far apart.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, if the train line connected from Richmond to Collingwood, it would be beautiful. Yeah. But sadly, that's not the case.
call out to the mayor. So how do you feel like that impacts your jiu-jitsu as a competitor, and you know, what are your thoughts on having your own school? Like, do you want to have your own school one day, teach full time? Is that the legacy you sort of want to create after you sort of finish a competitive career?
Yeah, I mean, definitely want to have my own school one day. I think that's like really one of the few ways to make money in jiu-jitsu. Like right now, this is the best situation for competition. Absolutely really good. They let me go away and compete a lot. When I was ready to settle down and start a club, I mean, it's going to be tough to get good training for myself. It's going to be tough to get time off to go travel and compete. So, yeah, I mean, it's the goal one day. I don't know when. Maybe when I start getting my ass kicked.
Yeah, right.
Ass kicked way too much, yeah.
Yeah, running a business is a totally different animal, you know, from being a competitor. You know, very few guys can do it successfully on both hands, you know?
Yeah, exactly. There's been very few that have made that transition. I mean, guys like the Mendez brothers, they're killing it business-wise. Yeah. I mean, they have both retired now. Galvao's killing it.
Galvao, yeah.
But I think, yeah, definitely there's going to be a period of time where they have to adjust. But obviously those guys are so high up, they're getting a lot of help with the business, I think. Lucky, I don't know how Lucky Giles does it.
Yeah, he's a physiotherapist as well, so.
Yeah, he's got a few things going on there.
Yeah, he does too much.
So what's on the horizon for you, Craig? As a black belt, I mean, you're a reasonably new black belt, but as only 2 years ago as a purple belt, you were representing Australia at ADCC, so, you know, now you got your black belt, you've done maybe one or two competitions in the gi, I think.
Oh, just one in the gi.
Just one in the gi?
Well, I still love competing in the gi, but it's been a long line of things. Like, I did brown belt worlds last year in the gi, and then I started training for ADCC trials.
Wait, so just go back 1 second. With the worlds, right, you won a few matches, I think, pretty quickly again. No surprise, triangle. And I think you came up against Hollando Sampson. It was somewhat pegged as the favorite for the weight division. You guys had a back and forth match where I think you landed a hip throw in like 10 seconds to go, and then he managed to reverse it and get the points.
Yeah, it was some bullshit there. That's two times I fought Orlando, and he's beat me by points. He beat me by 1 point both times. Yeah. Hopefully I get the rematch with him one day, but he has not been as active on the competition scene. I think he's into physiotherapy. I guess they're lucky, but maybe he will come back one day.
Luck was inspiring people around the world.
Yeah, but I think a lot of jiu-jitsu guys just want to heal their injuries.
Yeah, I mean, jiu-jitsu isn't a... I think I like that meme that went around, like, you know, welcome to jiu-jitsu and congratulations on your last day of being pain-free.
Yeah.
It's not exactly the easiest on the joints. So, I mean, with jiu-jitsu, I mean, I guess this is another contentious point of discussion. Do you think jiu-jitsu is for everyone? You know, I know that's something that's branded aligned with jiu-jitsu. I mean, I've got my own thoughts about it, but what are your thoughts?
I mean, I don't think everyone has to do jiu-jitsu. Like, it's just something fun. I consider jiu-jitsu, like, for the average person, sort of like a bit of a video game sort of where they get fit. You know what I mean? They're, like, problem-solving. They can go home, work out strategies. It's just a game. But does everyone have to do it? Definitely not. I think jiu-jitsu should be welcoming enough that everyone feels comfortable that they could start jiu-jitsu at any time. But, I mean, I don't think people all need to do it.
Have you ever had to deal with mat bullies or anyone who like just wants to make your life hell on the mat?
Lachlan Giles.
I mean, like, so anyone with perhaps with like a more malicious intent. Have you ever had to, you know, you've been training jiu-jitsu for about 10, 12 years, a long time.
Long time.
You're 26 years old now. Yeah. So, you know, you would have been almost like a little kid when you started.
Yeah, I was a kid, but luckily my old team, there were no kids classes, so I got thrown straight in with the adults, but they were pretty nice. Actually, when I started, my coach was a blue belt. So I started, he was a blue belt. Everyone else was white belts. So like training up, I was always at the sort of the top end. Do you know what I mean? Like even though 17, 18, I was still just at the top end of a bunch of white belts. So it was like, there was no higher belts out there trying to kill me.
So do you think you're being sandbagged because of the limitation of having a coach who's, you know, I imagine the situation was that if, you know, that you're always chasing the belt behind them and they can't really grade you until that point.
Yeah, like that was the case initially. Like he'd have to go up a belt for us to go up a belt. But he did have coaches that if we could, like if the time was right, I could have gone up. I spent probably a bit too long at purple belt, but I mean, some of the best gyms in the world, those guys will sandbag for years.
Until they've won the world championship.
Exactly. There's a lot of gyms that you don't go up unless you win, if you're a competitor. I think that messes with jiu-jitsu a bit, but it is the name of the game. And you could be still plenty of first and second year purple belts that win the world. Like the guys that have been there for 4 years, they don't often always win it after 4 years. You know what I mean? They probably end up feeling worse about the situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's quite a few competitors out there really sort of gunning for that world championship and sort of have to move on eventually.
Always the bridesman.
So as far as gi competitions, you are going to come back to the gi. I mean, you've sort of dabbled in it a bit locally, but big stage competitions?
Yeah, well, I registered as a black belt, so I got my membership card. That was mainly for no gi worlds this year, but I'll definitely jump back in for gi worlds next year. It's like there's been so many no-gi tournaments, no-gi opportunities. Like I was saying before, it was like I finished brown belt worlds, and the next thing was ADCC trials. Then it was no-gi worlds I was training for. Then it was EBI, and then it was Submission Underground, and now it's ADCC worlds. It's like I'm not a big fan of spreading my knowledge, but spreading my time between both when I'm preparing specifically for one, especially of the magnitude of those events. You know what I mean? I'm not going to get anything out of training in the gi right now for ADCC. So I'm best to leave it alone, not think about it, spend all my time and thought on no gi. But when the time's right and there's an opportunity in the gi, I'll definitely jump back in the gi. But I will do Pampax, actually. Pampax in the gi. I'm coming back for that.
Well, it's interesting. So I think with the gi, I mean, it does afford you a lot more sort of tools and handles. And, you know, again, I mean, to bring Ken back into the discussion, he's a guy who's really sort of pioneering and really growing it in that aspect with the gi. So I think there's definitely a lot of exciting different options with the gi. So how is that going to, I guess, factor into your game when you've really been specializing in the leg locks? So this is going to be, again, be a two-pronged question. So you've really been specializing in leg locks and working on your wrestling, but then how do you adapt a lot of those learnings, which are sort of, you know, limited to a certain rule set? How do you migrate that over to the gi game?
Oh, it'll be a tough road back, but so when I do chuck the gi on, when I have in the past chucked it on, like passing a guard no gi is so difficult that sometimes when you start rolling in the gi again, you're like, oh, I got all these handles. It's a bit easier to control someone. So like, I think they can complement each other, but yeah, it's going to be a tough road back. But the worm guard and stuff, I was still dealing with that when I was a brown belt. So the lapels are incredibly frustrating, but yeah.
Yeah, I think there's fewer things worse in jiu-jitsu than when you're getting like a lapel wrapped between your legs and it feels like you're being dental flossed up your spine.
Oh, for sure. We got Levi down from Sydney this week, so it's going to be a rough week if I put that gi back on.
Yeah, no, Levi's a beast. I remember I went over to New York a couple of years ago and I rocked up to this gym called Unity, and I knew it was a big time gym, and they had a free competitor class. And they shut the doors, they shut the windows. The heat is ridiculous, and it's just like a slip and slide. They're so sweaty.
Sweat pool, yeah.
I was just a sweat pool, and I've never felt so exhausted in my life. I felt like I was going to die. I had to drill with Levi and Bones, just an absolute beast of a man. And I remember after 20 minutes of drilling, I was wrecked. And then we had nearly 2 hours of rounds, and I don't think I remember the last half an hour. I remember crawling, looking for the smallest person possible just to escape, and I never found that person.
Yeah, I mean, even if you did find a small person, it wouldn't be that great.
And they're all just killers. I mean, that was a killer brother. Session.
Now, mate, I've got a question, more of a personal question for you, just to do with you getting your black belt. You know, for example, Brenton and I have known each other for a while now. I was there when Brenton was awarded his black belt, and I got to experience some of the emotion and some of the real victories.
You just see me cry.
I'm telling
on
you,
camera.
It was really moving. I'm going to tell you. But, I mean, just experiencing, you know, some of the victories that Brenton's overcome to get the black belt and everything that it means to him, it's a massive achievement. So for you personally, what does it mean to you to have gotten to the rank of black belt?
Oh, yeah, it meant a lot to me, especially coming. I was Lachlan Giles' first black belt, so it meant a lot, like having only been with the team a couple years at the time and him still feeling I was ready for the black belt, that meant a lot. It's been a long road to get here, especially with switching clubs. So, like, you think when you switch clubs, you're like, oh, it's going to be a few more years again. But yeah, I mean, it meant a lot, and it meant a lot that now I can get to face those really elite level guys.
I think Lachlan said something that's really, really important, actually very meaningful, when he said his speech when he awarded you the black belt was that he thought long and hard about it. And when it comes to giving a black belt, his idea of it is that if when you're being graded a black belt, you're going to be a better black belt than what he was when he got his black belt. So, I mean, you know, this is clearly a guy smashes you in training, you try to smash, but yeah, you know, gives that kind of respect.
Yeah, that's a very cool thing for him to say.
So do you have any sort of specific areas of grappling from here on you're going to be really focusing on? So we sort of keep bouncing back and forth on it. But you're working the wrestling, working the leg locks. What's the next big thing in jiu-jitsu then that people are going to be working on? Is it going to be like a hybrid wrestling where you've got wrestlers who start picking up submissions and start smashing everyone? Or
yeah, I definitely think that's it. Like, I think ADCC initially, when they changed the rules, so if you put like the overtimes, you lose a point if you lose a point in the final match at any time if you pull guard, that caused a lot of controversy. But over time, it's helped. Everyone's getting better at wrestling, and I think, like, right now we've got jiu-jitsu guys that are learning how to wrestle, and you've got wrestlers that are learning some jiu-jitsu. But I think, like, the next generation, that they're going to combine those two things very well. I mean, I still, like, Taugat, who's a Olympian and he coaches at Absolute, he shows me some stuff in wrestling that I can use in jiu-jitsu. Yeah. Some different grips, some different styles. So, like, those things combined kind of create some really dangerous guys.
And you got things like things from jiu-jitsu, for example, like the Kimura grip, which is one of the most diverse and widely utilized grips. You know, from that it opens up, you know, a myriad of options in jiu-jitsu. I can only imagine when you have someone like of a high level wrestler able to just get a Kimura grip and just start transitioning between different things to the level like some of the jiu-jitsu guys. I mean, I know the Kimuras and stuff, and you know, they called like double wrist lock is not exactly foreign to them. But I mean, you know, if you imagine a guy like Huston Kiev, like literally getting a Kimura grip and like flipping you over with that and rolling through with it, it's a devastating sight.
Oh, for sure. I mean, like in terms of the Kimura grip, I believe in college wrestling, you're not allowed to take the hand behind the back. It's got to stay in front. So, I mean, when wrestlers start doing jiu-jitsu, when they don't have to worry about such strict rules, we're going to see some interesting stuff.
That's really interesting as well. Yeah. So if you, there's a lot of limitations that they impose in the sport by nature, and you start removing those. Like I remember when Matt Hughes choked out, it was a Ricardo Almeida,
and he goes,
let's just the Schultz choke,
I think, yeah.
Is that what he called it? But he said something like, oh, that's just just an average, you know, college choke, you know, your choke you learn in college.
Yeah, I think the Schultz brothers used to put guys to sleep with it in wrestling, and then they banned the move, sadly.
So Craig's making like a 10-finger guillotine-style sort of grip, like a T-Rex choke. So what's coming up for you in terms of jiu-jitsu competitions? After this, I think you've got a super fight with a beast of a man, Robert Dib Frears.
Yeah, he is a beast. I've got ADCC end of September. ADCC the 23rd and 4th. On the 30th, I'm in Submission Underground against an MMA fighter. October 21, yeah, Bobby Faraz. That'll be a good one. That's the EBI rules. I've seen him killing everyone in Australia.
So it'll be Nogi.
Nogi, yeah. Nogi, EBI rules, EBI overtime. And he's killing everyone, but I haven't seen him with the heel hook game yet, so that'll be interesting. Mm. And then the following weekend, Pan Pax. And then Nogi Worlds before the end of the year. And maybe there is a tournament in Kazakhstan that I want to go back for. Because those guys, they take care of you when you go there.
Big party scene.
Yeah, after ADC, it was crazy. The craziest thing about ADCC in Kazakhstan, I feel like Kazakhstan's the best kept secret in jiu-jitsu. Those guys, like me and Lucky Giles lined up for like 20 minutes to take photos with the crowd. Like if you're in combat sports over there, you're like a hero.
That's even like that in Abu Dhabi though. Like in the hotel, I walked out, kids like want to take photos. I'm like, man, you want to take a photo with me? There's like 500 world champions in these other rooms.
It's a weird feeling, man.
So what else is going on? I think you've got a seminar coming up. Heel hook seminar.
Forgot about that. Yeah, we're hosting a heel hook seminar this Sunday at St Kilda. I believe it's at 12 p.m. But you should double check that. I think it's $30 minimum donation.
I'm sure there's a Facebook event for it.
Facebook event. Yep. Yeah. So all the money's going to go to cancer research.
Oh, fantastic.
Nice.
So it's MMA. Absolute MMA St Kilda.
Absolute MMA St Kilda. Yeah.
And what's that? Sunday the 31st. Is it?
Yeah, this Sunday at 12 p.m. I believe we'll go over our entire leg lock game.
That's exciting. I mean, this is
hopefully roll with everyone after. I want to do a gauntlet. The whole
sounds good. Get a live stream on Facebook.
Yeah, I should. I feel like there's going to be a lot of people there. I think the girls just had a seminar for the women's team, and there was maybe 70-80 people there.
Yeah, well.
So hopefully we can touch on that, make some good money for the charity.
Huge. I mean, look, again, these are championship-winning techniques. These are heel hooks that are, like, destroying the highest-level people at EBI, so definitely something you wouldn't want to miss. Any sponsors or anyone you want to shout out and people that have brought you here? I mean, obviously, you've mentioned you've got a really supportive crew that's helped you, that provided you the platform and helped enable you to, I guess, pursue your dreams in jiu-jitsu. Anyone you want to particularly name?
In terms of sponsors, MA1, Fight Life, and Saru Tape Company. In terms of just people, just Lockie Giles, I mean, he's taken all the success I've had. I really owe it back to him in terms of in what he's shown me and the job he's given me. Simon as well. Simon bringing me on with Absolute.
He's the owner of MMA1 Absolute?
Yeah, the owner of Absolute and MMA1. So, yeah, very good guy, even if he is very mean.
Very savvy businessman, managing to get his equipment in every rival gym.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Yeah, so those guys really helped me out a lot.
Awesome.
That's great. Yeah, so, mate, we just want to thank you so much for taking the time out to join us and to share a little bit about yourself and your journey to ADCC. Is there anything else you want to share before we wrap this up?
Nothing, actually, nothing too controversial. But, yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Craig. So hopefully Gordon Ryan and some of those guys are listening and they'll take up your challenge.
Hopefully. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome, mate. Well, thank you very much again for joining us, and we'll see you on the other side.